Isn't it odd? Australia has more uranium than almost any other nation on Earth, but we don't have nuclear power, unlike France or Britain or America. And again, we also have well-established technology, invented in Canberra long ago, to help bury nuclear waste. It's called SynRock, and it contains perovskite, one of the ingredients of the latest form of organic solar, paradoxically. SynRock was the brainchild of the late Ted Ringwood. And in the last few years, there's been much talk about Australia's possibly basing an industry on the repatriation and burial of nuclear waste. After all, apart from SynRock and its successors, we have plenty of space underground, theoretically. And as Terry Krieg, in a four-part series on this program, and others have suggested, there's a new generation of nuclear power plants on the drawing board, and we could, just could, be well-placed to help lead stage four of the industry. All this is what the Royal Commission on the Future of Nuclear Power for this country has been considering in South Australia. Well, Dr. Jim Green has his doubts. He's with Friends of the Earth and is based in Melbourne. And by the way, he will refer quite a lot to integral fast reactors, or IFRs. These are the new generation devices. Jim.
10 years ago, the uranium price was on an upswing. South Australians were dazzled by the prospect of becoming the Saudi Arabia of the South because of the state's large uranium deposits and the prospect of a global nuclear power renaissance. Those comparisons don't stand up to a moment's scrutiny. Australia would need to supply global uranium demand 31 times over to match Saudi oil revenue. 10 years on, how's the nuclear power renaissance going? The number of power reactors has actually declined, and Australia's uranium industry is also in decline and accounts for just 0.2% of national export revenue. Despite that experience, South Australians are once again being dazzled by the prospect of fabulous wealth. According to Liberal Senator Sean Edwards, a plan to import nuclear waste and to convert it into reactor fuel would generate wealth akin to being the Saudis of the South. How much money might be made by taking nuclear waste from other countries? No one has much idea, since there isn't any precedent. It's doubtful whether it would generate any more than a fraction of the revenue that Senator Edwards thinks it might. He thinks the income would cover the cost of building nuclear power reactors, it would enable the supply of free electricity to South Australians, and it would supplant the $4.4 billion in state taxes paid by South Australians each year. Some of the proponents of the waste-to-fuel plan believe that spent nuclear fuel is a multi-trillion dollar asset because it can be processed for reuse as reactor fuel, and they also believe that countries will pay tens of billions of dollars to relieve themselves of this multi-trillion dollar asset. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, and it's not hard to envisage the economics going pear-shaped, with the cost of managing nuclear waste over long periods of time exceeding the amount that's paid to accept it. The waste-to-fuel plan involves importing nuclear waste and processing it to fuel so-called integral fast reactors, or IFRs. IFRs don't exist, but they were the subject of an R&D program in the US for several decades. On the basis of that experience, GE Hitachi says it's willing to build an IFR if it can find a customer. The US and UK governments have shown some interest, and the reports published last year by those governments make for interesting reading. The US report notes that pursuit of IFR technology would be associated with major technical challenges, that it would take 18 years to construct an IFR and associated facilities, and that the IFR option is by far the most expensive option for dealing with the US stockpile of surplus plutonium. The UK report notes that IFR facilities have not been industrially demonstrated, that waste disposal issues remain unresolved, that GE Hitachi's timeframe of 14 to 18 years for development, licensing and construction is ambitious, and that little can be ascertained about cost, since GE Hitachi refuses to provide estimates of capital and operating costs. If IFRs are built, might they live up to expectations? Proponents claim that there is essentially no risk of a serious accident, and on that point we can agree. Reactor designs that exist only on paper are indeed risk-free. As a nuclear industry insider puts it, we know that the paper-moderated, ink-cooled reactor is the safest of all. He went on to warn that all kinds of unexpected problems may occur after a project has been launched. Likewise, nuclear engineer David Lockbaum says that the IFR looks good on paper, so good in fact that we should leave it on paper, for it only gets ugly in moving from blueprint to backyard. Proponents argue that countries with nuclear power programs are wedded to conventional reactor technology and that Australia has an opportunity to be a first mover in the development of innovative technology. That's one way of looking at it. Another perspective is that other countries have decided not to throw good money after bad, since the history of fast reactor technology has largely been one of extremely expensive, underperforming and accident-prone reactors. And instead of contributing to the resolution of proliferation problems by gobbling up weapons-usable material, fast reactors have repeatedly worsened proliferation problems. Claims that IFRs could not produce weapon-grade material have been refuted by a scientist who worked on an IFR prototype. Australia's IFR proponents claim that extensive safeguards and strong international oversight guard against the military use of nuclear facilities. But those claims don't stand up to scrutiny. During his tenure as the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Dr. Mohamed El-Baradei said that the agency's safeguard system suffers from vulnerabilities and clearly needs reinforcement, that efforts to improve the system have been half-hearted, and that the safeguard system operates on a shoestring budget comparable to that of a local police department. Moreover, the Australian government is seriously weakening the already seriously weak safeguard system. The government has signed a uranium sales agreement with India that weakens safeguard standards in many respects. The agreement is currently before Federal Parliament's Treaties Committee, and in its current form, the agreement has been strongly opposed by a former Director General of the Australian Safeguards and Non-Proliferation Office, a former Chair of the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency, a former Assistant Director of the US Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, and an Australian nuclear arms control expert. The objections of John Cowson, who headed Australia's Safeguards Office for 21 years, carry particular weight. He argues that the agreement with India represents a serious weakening of Australia's safeguards conditions and that the weaknesses in the agreement mean Australian material could be used in support of India's nuclear weapons program. If the uranium agreement is approved, there will be sustained pressure for Australia to apply equally inadequate standards to other countries. Worse still, other nuclear and uranium exporting countries will follow Australia's lead. Those aren't just the concerns of fringe dwellers, as Senator Edwards calls anyone who opposes his nuclear plans. They are also the concerns of experts and former high-ranking officials with solidly pro-nuclear credentials. A rigorous safeguard system isn't an optional extra. It ought to be a necessary precondition for uranium exports, and it ought to be a necessary precondition for any discussion about expanding Australia's role in the nuclear fuel cycle. One final comment on safeguards. American IFR proponent Tom Blees argues for radically strengthened safeguards, including the creation of an international strike force to respond to any detected attempts to divert nuclear materials. He also argues that privatised nuclear power should be outlawed worldwide and that nuclear power must either be internationalised or banned to deal with the threat of nuclear weapons proliferation. Australia's IFR proponents are having none of that. They haven't shown the slightest interest in the government's current moves to radically weaken safeguards, and they haven't made any contribution to the inquiry being conducted by the Treaties Committee. Evidently, it's just so much easier to trot out comforting cliches about extensive safeguards and strong international oversight. Proposals for Australia to take the lead in developing IFRs will most likely come to nothing, but that still leaves the option of taking other countries' nuclear waste and disposing of it in a deep underground repository. Only one such repository exists anywhere in the world, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP, in New Mexico. WIP stores long-lived intermediate-level waste from the US nuclear weapons program. In February last year, a heat-generating chemical reaction ruptured one of the barrels stored underground at WIP, and this was followed by a failure of the filtration system, which was meant to ensure that radiation did not reach the outside environment. 22 workers were exposed to low-level radiation. The total cost to fix up the mess will top $500 million, and WIP will be shut for at least 4 years. A US government report points the finger at the operator and regulator of WIP, noting their failure to fully understand, characterise and control the radiological hazard, compounded by degradation of key safety management programs and safety culture. A safety analysis conducted before WIP opened predicted that one radiation release accident might occur every 200,000 years. On the basis of real-world experience, that estimate needs to be revised upwards to over 13,000 accidents over a 200,000-year period. Is there any reason to believe that Australia would manage a nuclear waste repository any more responsibly than the US? Not that I can think of. Is there any reason to believe that things might be worse in Australia? Yes, the US has a wealth of nuclear expertise at its disposal. Australia has comparatively little. Moreover, Australia has its own troubled history dealing with long-lived nuclear waste. In the late 1990s, the federal government oversaw a clean-up of the Maralinga nuclear test site in South Australia. The government said the Maralinga clean-up was world's best practice, even though it breached Australian standards for the management of long-lived nuclear waste. A leaked email written by an officer with the Commonwealth Nuclear Regulator said that the clean-up was beset by a host of indiscretions, shortcuts and cover-ups. A scientist-turned-whistleblower said the dumping of long-lived nuclear waste in shallow, unlined pits at Maralinga was a cheap and nasty solution that wouldn't be adopted on Whitefellas land. Another scientist-turned-whistleblower said the government's technical report was littered with gross misinformation. Barely a decade after the Maralinga clean-up, a survey revealed that 19 of the 85 contaminated waste pits have already been subject to erosion or subsidence. A recent poll by the Adelaide Advertiser found that less than 1 in 6 South Australians want the state to host an international nuclear waste repository. More than 5 out of 6 count themselves amongst Senator Edwards' fringe dwellers.
That was Jim Green from Friends of the Earth. Next week, Frank Santo goes benchmarking cosmology. I'm Robin Williams.